I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Spark My Muse podcast. Today, my guest is Karen Gonzalez. Buenvenidos. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I was thinking maybe we could do this one in Spanish, but then I thought, no, your Spanish stinks, Lisa. Don't do it. And also the listeners are pretty much English speakers, so I think we'd be in trouble. But it is really fun to have you on today, and I wanted to kind of switch things up for listeners today. And instead of me introducing you and trying to get my take on what you do, I wanted you to sort of take it away and tell people what you do as your day-to-day job, and then we'll dig into more of your story, because it's a fascinating and interesting story, what I know so far, and I'll ask you questions along the way, too, as you get into it, but I think you have a wonderful story I can't wait to share. So what is it that you do day-to-day, Karen?
So I work for an organization that primarily works with immigrants, so they resettle refugees, and they also provide legal services for immigrants, do anti-trafficking work with foreign-born people, and that's their work in the U.S., and they are a Christian organization, mm-hmm. And so in my work with them, I've had a variety of roles. I started out working in church engagement, so basically going to churches and educating them mm-hmm. about immigration and raising awareness about the needs of immigrants and how to serve them, particularly mm-hmm. with refugees, because they, you know, refugees come here and don't have any ties, mm-hmm. any familial ties. And so, you know, it's like being dropped off in a new country and you don't know the culture, you don't know the language, and you don't know how to take your kid to school. And so, so church volunteers basically come alongside people to help them with for about 6 months. They partner with them and volunteer. So I did that for about a year and a half or so, and then I transitioned, and right now I'm working in HR doing recruiting for them, and I'm also doing training. You know, there's a lot of different mm-hmm. things that are involved with getting staff prepared to work with immigrants, and so so that's what I do now.
And do most of these people come like, what are their situations when they come, and what countries are they usually coming from? You're in the Baltimore area, right?
Correct. So in Baltimore, in terms of legal services, we work with a lot of Central Americans. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know how much you've heard about this, but there are these gangs terrorizing primarily Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. And so we have a lot of asylum seekers coming and fleeing that violence. And so Baltimore, those are the big Latino communities. There's also smaller communities of West Africans and people from the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And in terms of refugees, we primarily have Congolese, Ethiopians, Eritreans. We also have Iraqis and Afghans. And, you know, we've resettled a few Syrian families, but really, for the most part, it's been Iraqis and Afghans, and primarily those people who have been serving the U.S. military and mm-hmm. helping them. Mm-hmm. And so now it's not safe for them to remain in their country as a result of having worked with us. Mm. And so we give them, you know, refugee status here. So those are primarily the groups that we have in Maryland.
I've always been curious, too, when people come here, they pretty much nothing, they have no connections, and they're just escaping for their lives. And how do they even get the money to come? Do you know these stories, or do you know how they do it?
Yeah, so actually there's like a really robust system that's in place. And what happens is the U.S. government, so you have to flee from mm-hmm. one country to another country. So mm-hmm. you've left, let's say, Ethiopia, and you've gone to Liberia, where you're seeking, you know, mm-hmm. And there you contact the UN and you apply for refugee status. Mm-hmm. And this takes many years. The average wait is about 14 years. Mm-hmm. And so some of that time is just waiting, but a a big chunk of it is also vetting. They want to make sure that you don't have terrorist ties, that who you say you are is who you are. They interview you. It's a very, very long, rigorous process. And then once you're accepted, so let's say you get accepted to come to the U.S., then the government will give you a loan, a travel loan. And you use that travel loan to get back to get to the U.S. And once you get here, you start to pay back that loan. Now, that loan has no interest, and it helps you to build a credit history, and it helps other refugees to come because now there's money, you know, for them to also get a travel loan to come over. And so that's the way that they do it. So they do pay it back. And depending on where you're from, you know, if you're coming from somewhere in the Middle East or somewhere in Africa, your loan could be $2,000, $3,000. If you're coming with your whole family, it could be $10,000, you know, just depends on your situation. But there is no interest on it. Mm-hmm. It's just to help you to get here and to establish a credit history and to help others going forward. And then they connect you once you're here with a resettlement agency. Mm-hmm. And the resettlement agency provides you some support for some time through grants from the government. And so they help you for about 4 months. So, you know, they don't come here and just live off the government forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, they arrive here and then they have, you know, they do get a work permit. Mm-hmm. So they're legally here. They receive in the beginning food stamps, they receive help getting a social security card, all those things. All that's done with the help of volunteers too. Mm. And then they're expected to be up and running on their own in about 4 months. And so, Wow. Yeah, it's really...
You know, totally new country, not knowing the language and not having any idea of how this country works. That's incredible.
Yeah, to expect it really that. Is.
Oh. Yeah, because I'm thinking like just dropping me off as a tourist somewhere... Just, I can't even imagine. And so then they are expected to get work to pay off their loan and all that stuff. Do they have support to try to find work or something? How do they do that when they don't know the language?
They do get support. And primarily, of course, depending on their situation, you know, some refugees come here and they were, you know, I remember meeting people that were like a doctor and an accountant in their country. And then they come here, but they don't speak English. Mm-hmm. Their degrees don't transfer. Mm. You have to get retraining. And so so the government does offer some classes that they can take. And I've actually taught in refugee assistance programs through community colleges here in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. So there are like forklift classes and nursing aid classes. And so you learn, or commercial driving classes. Mm-hmm. Also, a lot of people do janitorial work, cleaning office buildings in the evenings. So work that does not require initially a lot of language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they also are given support of English classes if they want to take them. Mm. So, yeah, so they are given some support. I mean, it's not what I would say a desirable life in terms of it's very hard for them. And, you know, I mean, I worked with a woman who was in her country. She was Congolese and she was a nurse and, you know, worked with Doctors Without Borders in her country. And now she's in the U.S. and she's a nurse's aide, you know, and starting all over again from the bottom, you know, and now you're in your 40s, you know, it's very humbling to me. And to me, it's taught me a lot about the resiliency of the human spirit, how much people just don't give up. They keep, they start over again, you know, and they envision a different life for their children. And often the lives of the refugee children are better because they learn English and they're here and learn the culture. But yeah, it's a very, very difficult transition.
Yeah, so that's a good transition for us to get into more of your story. But I wanted to also ask, because you're working at a Christian organization, what was your early formation in spiritual or religious tradition?
Sure. So I grew up in the Catholic Church, but I would say my parents were more nominal Catholics. So, you know, my parents were from Guatemala, and culturally, lots of people are Catholic. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was baptized and I did my first communion, and these were, you know, big deal sort of things. But I would say, you know, my dad was a socialist and my mom really was just very nominal in her belief. And tied with all that was a lot of superstition too. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't grow up, I would say, with any kind of strong faith formation. But when I was a senior in college, my mom died. Mm-hmm. She got a very aggressive form of cancer and passed away. And she was really young. I mean, she hadn't even turned 40. And so, you know, that sort of set me on a new trajectory. And I began, when I was in college, to sort of think more about faith and mm-hmm. what it meant and what meaning there was, especially what meaning there was in my mother's death and, you know, why that happened. And so when I was in college, I began to get involved with a group called InterVarsity that you mm-hmm. might have heard yeah. of. And yeah, and they do, you know, college ministry, and they're Protestant based, I would say. Mm-hmm. So I got involved with them. And, you know, and after college, I just got involved in the church that a lot of my InterVarsity, you know, classmates went to, which was a really conservative evangelical mm-hmm. church, where I would say most of the theology came from, you know, white male theologians mm-hmm. and, you know, very patriarchal. And that's the environment I was in mm-hmm. for a lot of years. And I mean, I didn't really fit, to be honest, because I was a single woman, first of all. And mm-hmm. in that environment, you know, where women's highest calling is being a wife and mother, like right. single women really have no place until you get married. Mm-hmm. So, but I went to serve overseas. I went to, I had been trained as an English teacher, and I went overseas to Kazakhstan and taught English mm-hmm. for a few years. And I wanted to pursue more long-term kind of work overseas, but I thought I needed training. And since I'd been overseas, I wasn't a missionary, but I was with a Christian mm-hmm. service agency. I decided to pray about going to seminary. So I did. I went mm-hmm. to seminary, to Fuller Seminary out in California. And that really honestly saved my faith mm-hmm. because it was justice oriented. It was very pro-women, pro-women mm-hmm. leaders and pastors. And it was also very much one of those places that helped you to embrace your culture, that mm. sort of decolonized Christianity for me.
Yeah.
That I learned to see how, wow, a lot of the Christianity that I learned was from one particular perspective. And not that that mm-hmm. perspective is all wrong, but it's not the only story out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah, so that's kind of been my journey. And I would say Fuller was very transformative in just helping me to become more aware and even to become more connected to my immigrant identity and to embrace that, like you said.
Yeah. Well, your story of coming to America is great. You gave me the outline, the broad strokes probably, but you're an immigrant and come from Guatemala, right? And maybe you can
Correct.
Tell me, you can tell me how did it start that your parents decided time to go, let's go to America?
So my parents lived very happily in Guatemala. I would say my parents were the kind of people who never wanted to leave. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they both had some success in their country. My mom was a nurse and my dad worked for an NGO. So my dad had a few years of college, and he worked for an American NGO and did a lot of work serving primarily the indigenous people mm-hmm. In Guatemala, and traveled quite a bit when I was young. And they were really content with this life. We'd had a lot of relatives come to the U.S. And leave Guatemala, but my parents, we would come visit. Mm-hmm. We came on vacation a couple of times, but they had no interest in leaving. As a matter of fact, my uncle had filed one immigrant visa for my dad, and my dad was like, I'm not interested. Mm-hmm. You know, I really want to stay here. Mm-hmm. But what ended up happening is that a civil war broke out in Guatemala, mm-hmm. and it just, you know, it was a civil war funded by the U.S. Basically, they were afraid that the country would become communist because Cuba had become communist, and mm-hmm. it all seems so ridiculous now. But back then, communism was still a very real threat to people. Mm-hmm. And so under particularly Ronald Reagan, they funded this civil war, and the government that received the money in Guatemala basically used it to terrorize its own people. Mm-hmm. And so you know, a lot of people were disappearing, a lot of people were dying, and whole villages were getting, you know, slaughtered by the military. And I remember one time my parents talking about one of their friends, and these are people that we knew whose children we played with, and they disappeared. And they were found like tortured and, you know, murdered like a month later. And so these things started to happen more and more frequently, as well as the economy of the country started declining as a result of these government issues. And so there came a point at which my parents recognized that it was not safe, particularly because my dad had been involved with the Communist Party and still was. And
Yeah,
and there was a time when they came into our house and took, you know, all my father's books on Marxism and socialism. And so my dad left first, actually. He left and came to the U.S., and my uncle filed an immigrant visa again for him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fortunately, my uncle was a U.S. citizen. He'd married an American citizen, and there was a much shorter waiting time. So nowadays, if my uncle sponsored my dad, his brother, it would be a 12-year wait on average for that visa to become available. So you can see why people get desperate and leave. If you're in a situation where you feel like you're in danger, you don't want to sit around waiting 12 years.
Yeah, and you could be dead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my dad came. We'd had a multiple entry tourist visa. So he came on that and just overstayed the visa. And we followed about a year later. My mom, you know, packed up everything and sold things, and then we came and joined him, and their visa expired about 6 months after we arrived, and so they just overstayed the visa. So we were undocumented about 2.5 years, and then our visa became available. And at that point, we had to go back to Guatemala to the U.S. Embassy there for our interview. And so we did, and it was approved, and we came back to the U.S. with our green cards. And so that was our process, and I never realized how easy that process was compared to what a lot of people go through, you know, and just the waits that people have now. Some people have as long as 23 years before a visa becomes available. So,
I have some questions about that because, you know, you hear – I don't want to get, obviously I mentioned this earlier that like I don't do a political show, but I do have some questions about how does it work with overstaying visas and like how do you get back into your own country when you've overstayed a visa and you're trying to get back to your own country on an expired visa? Do you have to pay a fine on that, or do you just go back in, or like because you know, undocumented, like there's such a stigma with illegal aliens, right? And undocumented people.
Right.
And that's how a lot of people get in on overstayed visas. And then there's this like panic, oh, illegal aliens. And a lot of people are just trying to get in however they can, right? To escape whatever they need to escape. And you guys, your family, I mean, were able to get in, and you were undocumented for a little while, and then you went back and came in, you know, on a regular visa. And it was one of those situations where your dad could have been, who knows what would have happened to him potentially, right? So that was the safest way for your family to do that. But how do you get like into the airport and out of there when your visas are expired and everything?
Well, actually, going back with an expired visa is not a problem. It's that once you're here and your visa's expired, you don't want to be caught with it, you know? So, you know, I didn't know because I was young. I was, you know, 9, 11 when we got our green card. But my dad actually told me how he and my mom were really afraid. They would hear about raids happening in certain places, and they were just really afraid that that would happen to them. And so it's living here. So because they were admitted into the country because they had a visa, so they went through U.S. customs and passport control and all of that. So that's actually a little bit better than being an undocumented immigrant that just crosses the border.
Oh, right. Okay.
because they weren't admitted, but we were admitted into the country, but we overstayed, and that's the undocumented part. That's, you know, and of course there's, you know, you can, there's actually a Supreme Court case that says your children can go to school even if you're undocumented. So my parents weren't worried about that. They were mostly worried that in their work, because they were no longer doing professional kind of work. You know, my dad was working at a hotel, picking up trash, and my mom was working as a, like, sort of like a home healthcare assistant because she couldn't be a nurse here. And so that was their fear, is just getting picked up. But once, so it used to not be an issue. So for example, before the Clintons came into, or Bill Clinton, I should say, he was the president, before he became president, it used to not be that bad. But nowadays, if you have any kind of, if you've accumulated unlawful presence in the U.S., then you, and you weren't admitted into the country, you would have, you'd be barred from the country up to 10 years.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's pretty serious.
And so then how do you get work when you're undocumented then? Or you can't get it?
No, you can. It's an excellent question. So, you know, this is one of those things that I don't understand about our government, because on the one hand, you have the Department of Homeland Security saying we're tracking down undocumented immigrants and we're going to gather them and deport them back to their country. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you have the Social Security Administration and then you have the IRS, who will give undocumented immigrants, the IRS will give them what's called an individual tax identification number. And they know that they're undocumented and they know they're using this to work, but they want their tax money. And
that's the missing link that I haven't been understanding. When people are like, I am paying taxes. And you're like, how are they paying taxes when they're not documented? Oh, they're like, oh no, we'll take your money. That's fine.
Oh yeah.
That's so sneaky.
Yeah. 75% of undocumented immigrants pay payroll, Social Security, Medicare taxes that they're never going to receive back any of those benefits.
That's not nice at all.
Yeah. Right. So some people get that number. Some people just buy, they buy a fake Social Security card. You know, you can buy them on the street. You can also buy a fake green card on the street, you know, which of course, you know, a DHS agent would know, an ICE agent would know this is fake. But the average employer doesn't really know that. And so they just take it at face value. And so, yeah, it's not hard. And the fact is, there's a lot of labor need, particularly at the very low end and the very high end of the spectrum of labor. And so, yeah, they have no problem finding work.
Wow. Yeah, especially for things like, we wouldn't really have any like fruit or vegetables probably if people weren't coming in and picking those things and doing some of the hardest labor in the country if undocumented people weren't helping with doing the jobs that other people won't do.
Yeah. I mean, and there's just a lot of work that I didn't realize how much immigrants do, like slaughterhouses, agriculture, even things, if you think about it, like in Baltimore, all the laundry, that commercial laundry that is done for hospitals in Baltimore is all immigrant labor, you know, and, you know, Johns Hopkins Hospital, you know, this fancy, prestigious hospital. I mean, you need somebody to provide clean linens for this place. So anyway, yeah, there's a lot of labor that they provide. And, you know, so many immigrants are invisible, but we would know it if they suddenly disappeared.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. They're talking out of both sides of their mouth on that one. I really didn't know that. I appreciate that you're mentioning that. And yeah, obviously there has to be a lot done to make the situation equitable for everybody. Like people are talking about, oh, well, the jobs are getting, you know, my job's getting taken away by an undocumented immigrant, but it's probably not a job that they would take, you know, and because it's already being taken, but it's probably not a job they would ever want to have. And it's really an interesting and weird system. And a lot of people are pitting one against another and nobody's really solving the actual problem. It just kind of hobbles along. And it really is sad because there's obviously a lot of injustice that can happen with just I see these undocumented folks as able to be really victimized because they don't have any real recourse, because they're going to potentially live in a lot of fear of getting sent back to a dangerous situation for them. So in your work, do you have to do you work to provide them, or I know you work with a lot of refugees, but do you work to provide people with legal counsel and things like that to protect them against some of the abuses that can happen when they're not documented?
That's right. So a lot of our refugee resettlement office also have a immigration legal services as part of it, because even refugees, even though they're legally here in this country, they still need to apply for a green card, to sponsor relatives, to become citizens. And so those legal services are available to any immigrant. Anyone in the community can come in and receive those services. And they're very low cost, and they're very knowledgeable about it, because that's one of the things with immigration law. It's very complicated, and so you want to find someone who has a lot of experience and who can navigate that system well, and can also help you with other issues surrounding it, you know, like if something comes up and you need support. So sometimes, for example, immigrants will be victims of crime. And many of them are afraid to call the police because they think, oh no, if I call the police, they're going to deport me. But actually, in many cities, and you know, Baltimore is one of them, the police will work with immigrants, and they won't communicate with ICE or, you know, any kind of immigration office, because they want immigrants to come forward, and they actually will give them a certified police report for cooperating with the police in the U.S. And the district attorney. And you can actually get an immigrant visa for doing that if you will, you know, if you're a victim of a serious crime. So, you know, we had clients who were victims of crimes, like this one man, you know, putting his key into his house, coming home from work, was severely beaten and robbed, and woke up in the hospital 3 days later with really severe injuries. And he was undocumented, but he was very afraid to report to the police what happened to him. But, you know, the attorneys that work with us talk to them about, no, actually, you should cooperate. You're not going to get deported over this. We want you to report it. We want you to cooperate. And this will be what will happen if you do that. Not only will you receive justice in terms of these people going to prison for what they did to you, but and this to encourage immigrants, because a lot of cities were recognizing that immigrants were not reporting crimes happening to them because they were afraid that, you know, this was going to put them in a dangerous situation of getting deported. So there's a lot of support that immigrants receive from our offices beyond just, you know, legal pathway, and just support all around for life in a new country with new laws. A lot of people don't know that, for example, in the U.S., domestic violence is illegal. In a lot of countries, it's not illegal.
Oh, wow.
And so a lot of times that crime goes unreported because people don't, or, you know, crimes like sexual assault, where people are used to, in their countries, women aren't believed and women aren't, you know, and so they don't report them. And so a lot of it is trying to serve immigrants to help them to be less vulnerable, because that's what it is to be vulnerable, right? Like so many things can happen to you, and nobody knows and nobody cares, and you don't receive any justice. And so that's a lot of the work that our organization tries to do, is to serve immigrants to be the people God created them to be, people with dignity, you know, created in His image, who should be able to live lives freely, you know.
Yeah, and why empower people who are criminals and people who target already oppressed people? Why, you know, why empower a criminal element in your city that go after people like that? Like, it's just really, why feed that fire? It's crazy to think. It's crazy to think that would be overlooked. Like, oh no, don't worry, we'll let you target this group because we're fine with that. You know, it's just like, it's just insane to think that that could be overlooked, you know, that this population of people, well, they're not documented, so we're not going to really worry about them. Well, I'm kind of curious to know, as you're coming to the United States as a little girl, what was going through your mind, and could you speak English at the time, and did you have to adjust to all that?
Yeah, no, I didn't speak any English. I mean, I knew a few words here and there, mostly things like ice cream, please. But I did not speak English. And at the time, so we moved to California. We lived there for a very short time. And, you know, at the time, the big thing in California was bilingual education. And what they had were basically these dual tracks where you would get educated in your own language. But so my parents were noticing that we just weren't learning English. And thankfully, you know, my parents, because they were educated in their own country, they could advocate for us, which I'm very thankful for. And they went to the school and basically took responsibility for us. They said, look, we want them to be in classes all in English. Mm. And the school was like, no, they can't do that. They need to be in ESL. My parents are like, no, put them in all English classes. And so they had to actually had to sign that they were taking responsibility for this. Mm. And so we were put in all English classes, which was really hard. I mean, yeah. We didn't speak, you know, my brother and I didn't speak any English, and here we were. But we did learn English really quickly that way, just out of a sheer need to want to communicate and want to, you know. And we both did well. And my parents eventually moved to Florida, in part because it was a much friendlier environment for immigrants, with the Cuban population in Florida being so successful and having been there for so long. I mean, at the time when we moved there, the governor was a man of Spanish descent, Bob Martinez. Mm-hmm. And so my parents felt like that was going to be a good environment. And it really was. There's a very sort of positive vibe in Florida toward immigrants, or there was at that time anyway, because most of the immigrants were Puerto Ricans or Cubans. Mm-hmm. These are two groups that are both legal, you know, migrants. Mm-hmm. Cubans as refugees and Puerto Ricans because they are Americans. Mm-hmm. And so it was a really good environment. But you know, we lived in a neighborhood where we were the only ones. So us and our two cousins were the only Latinos that we knew in our school. Our school had no ESL program, you know. It was just a white school. And yeah, that was our education. And I think in part that was very, very hard. Mm-hmm. But it was also good in the sense that it helped us to learn the system well and learn how to navigate ourselves in that system, so that going to college and beyond wasn't as challenging as it could be, right? If you're coming from an urban school and a different sort of social culture. Mm. So.
Wow. And then what did you decide to study in college?
Well, that's an interesting story. So we were playing a game once here at work, and it was called, you're just going around asking and the question was, I love my parents, but, and you had to complete the question. So mine was, I love my parents, but they're immigrants. And I mean that in the best sense, in that, you know, because they're immigrants, they don't want you to major in musical theater, as wonderful as musical theater is, you know, or art. And I started off majoring in English and art history and French, because I didn't know what I really liked. And I did a study abroad in art history. And my dad was so anxious about this. He was so worried that I would come out of college and not have a job. And so he was trying to pressure me to change my major to engineering, which I was never going to do. I'm more of a humanities kind of girl. So I did change it to English education. And, you know, I became a teacher because of that, because my dad was so, you know,
need that practical skill.
Yeah. He's like, fine, if you want to major in English, fine, but just do something that's practical. And so, yeah. So that's, I became a teacher, and I was a public school teacher for a few years. Not something that I really enjoyed, but it was a good, you know, it was good to work in public service and to understand that system well, you know.
And then how did you get to Baltimore then?
So I got to Baltimore because really my family is all from the East Coast, and my brother and his wife live here because they both work for the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister lives in like New England. So really in Florida, the only person left is my dad. And so after I finished seminary and I had a job out there where I got laid off working for another international development organization, you know, I really was thinking about coming back to the East Coast because all my family's here, but did not want to move back to Florida because there isn't really a job market for me there. Mm-hmm. But there is in the D.C. area. And so initially I thought I would live and work in D.C., but I got connected volunteering and working with refugees here in Baltimore. Initially, I was just a volunteer. I was teaching English with Catholic Charities to the unaccompanied minors.
Mm-hmm.
And then through that, I started teaching as an adjunct in the refugee program at the community college. And I got really connected with that refugee immigrant community here in Baltimore. And then a position opened up here at World Relief. And I had a good friend who, you know, helped connect me with the right people. So that's kind of how that worked out, very organic. But yeah, initially, I was just really teaching and working with that community very closely to where I got to see what they were experiencing day to day and how hard life was, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that things have changed so much. You probably feel very grateful for your immigrant experience as you've had it, because things have taken so many hard turns now for that population.
Yeah. It's really, and you know, it's one, like when my parents came, our current immigration system came into being in 1965. That's where the Immigration Nationality Act came into being. And when my parents immigrated here, that was only about 15 years old, you know, it was not very old. And it still worked for a lot of people. But now our immigration system is very outdated. It no longer really serves us in the way that it could. And it's we have these challenges, you know, among them, the Dreamers, the people who come here as children and are undocumented. And this is the only life they know. And now they're being told they're going to be deported, you know, back to a country they don't even know because they came here as toddlers or young children. So there's a lot of challenges now that our system really needs to be updated. Mm-hmm. It needs reform because our country has changed and the needs have changed. Our labor needs have changed and also the needs of our neighbors. This is the greatest refugee crisis in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, it's worse even than after World War II. We've created some of these immigrants and refugees,
mm-hmm.
you know, waging our wars in other countries, mm-hmm. interfering in elections and foreign governments. So, you know, one of the saddest things to me is the immigration right now from Central America. A lot of it is happening because all the people that came when my parents came, okay, they're fleeing the civil wars, you know, in Central America, they came and settled in urban areas predominantly, right? Their children are in LA. They're trying to protect themselves from Mexican gangs and African-American gangs. And so they form their own gangs, mm-hmm. right, to create a sense of belonging as well. And so they go to prison because of gang activity.
Mm-hmm.
They come out of prison, they get deported, which is very common.
Mm-hmm.
They get deported, but they go back to the countries that they don't even know, right? They go back to El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras, and they regather their gangs and start terrorizing now their own people.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these Central American gangs made in America, you know, it's just a very, very sad situation. So we have a lot of vulnerable people around the world and we just can't turn away from them. You know, there's a lot of, so in any case, yeah, I do believe that I feel very grateful for my immigration story and how quickly it was resolved. But it also makes me feel a lot of compassion for people are going through now. And when I hear people say things like, why don't they just get in line, you know, and I'm like, there are no lines. There are no-
you mean the 20-year line?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's easy to say that when you live comfortably and you don't have to worry about that, and you don't you know, people don't, I don't think people know any better. They just hear, you know, tweets and rhetoric, and they don't really understand what it's really like, you know, because they haven't talked to anybody probably who's really going through it. They just hear tweets and sound bites and rhetoric. And that's why it's good to hear somebody who's actually working with these people, or somebody who's actually gone through it. Because these are real people. Like that's what drives me crazy. These are actually, this isn't just an idea about what we should do. These are real people with real lives and real kids. They've gone through pain. They're escaping something. They would probably really want to stay in their country if they could. Like, I think that's people, like, they're coming to take something from me. I think they'd like to stay in their homeland if they could.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, like, this is their home. Like, my grandparents are from Puerto Rico. My dad was born in Brooklyn, but they would move from Florida. They'd move to Brooklyn. They move back to Puerto Rico, then to Florida, then back to Puerto Rico. And my grandmother would say, I want to go to my homeland. It was the United States, but she would always want to go back to the island. And then she would be like, then they'd move back. There wasn't not enough opportunity there. They don't have the same doctors. And she'd fuss about that. And then they'd move back because she would still want to be where things were most familiar to her. And, you know, even we're not talking about a different country, but people do want to stay where it's most familiar if they could. But if they have a chance to move to a place that works out better, that will help them with some of their needs or give their children a better chance, they're going to do it, and they're going to try to do it. But the system is truly broken when people are running for their lives, but they will have to wait for decades. And it's no wonder that people risk their own lives and die in the process when they're just trying to, you know, eke out a better existence. I don't think we can fault people for that. Like, what else would you do? You know, anybody in that situation would probably do the exact same thing.
Yeah. And and that's why I think one of the best ways to, when I talk to people about, when they're like, well, how can I respond? What can I do? Mm-hmm. I always tell them one of the best things that you can do is you can, well, one, examine your own views of immigration, because like you said, a lot of people hear tweets and, you know, cable news or their racist grandpa or, you know, and they just internalize those beliefs about immigration or this rhetoric that they hear. So I always tell people, examine your views and think about things like, do I really have my facts right? Where have my views on immigration come from? And if you're a Christian, are they primarily informed by the Bible, you know, by Jesus' command to love and welcome the stranger? Or are they informed by fear, you know, and other factors? And then telling immigrant stories, because it's very easy to say, well, I'm against illegal immigration and, you know, I'm against this or that. But it's quite different to hear the story of someone telling you about their struggle. You know, there's this great Native American proverb that says, tell me a fact and I'll learn. Tell me a truth and I'll believe, but tell me a story and it'll live in my heart forever. Mm. It's very hard to say someone, that's not your story, you know, that's their story. And so hearing immigrant stories really does build empathy.
Yeah.
And they stories really communicate to the heart and the mind. And when I go talk to people about immigration, I always tell them an immigrant story. And in the story that I tell, one of the stories that I tell them, they see how many immigrants have tried different avenues, different lines to get into to become documented. And that for some, there are simply no lines. And for some, the waits are so long, you know, they would lose their lives before they would ever get a chance. And so I think that really, it's one of the best ways to advocate is to tell stories instead of arguing rhetoric and talking about this or that. Mm-hmm. Tell a story about an immigrant. And if you don't know a story, you know an immigrant. So ask them their story. How did you come, you know, to live here? Or how did your family come here? Mm. So,
yeah. And if you don't know an immigrant, start looking.
Yeah. They're all around you.
Yeah. Start looking. And I think there is a lot of fear. There's fear from people who are immigrants that they're scared that they're going to get turned in. And then there's fear from people who are afraid that I should say, you know, this is on the other side of like, well, you know, immigrants can do crimes and they're not going to get deported. And it's like the number of people who are committing crimes that are undocumented is really tiny. Like this is the thing that I don't, that's another thing of rhetoric that, yes, crimes are committed by people who are undocumented and illegal, you know, coming illegal across, running across the border or something, that does happen. But a lot of the people who are coming here are just trying to make a better life for them, their kids, their families, with families. And I think that that's part of the, sadly, those stories of violence are really used like straw men to demonize a whole bunch of people, a whole population. And it's when you hear the stories, like you're saying, when you hear the stories of people who are just simply trying to get out of harm's way, mm-hmm. that you realize this problem is a lot bigger than, you know, career criminals trying to come after people in your town or something.
Yeah. You know, here's the thing. Anything, you know, if I decided I'm going to find all the mean redheads in Baltimore, and that's what I was looking for, I can guarantee you I would find them. I would find all the redheads that have bad attitudes. And in any community, there are going to be people who are criminals. It does not mean that those people represent the entire community. And in fact, when we have had the highest rates of immigration, and we're at a low point right now, actually, but when we have had the highest rates, crime has dropped. In fact, over a 10-year period in the U.S., ending in 2005, crime dropped 34% as immigration rates increased. And so immigrants really are good citizens. They come here for two reasons. They come to reunite families and they come to work. You know, like most immigrants are in their prime working ages and they come here to work. And so really what they do is they self-select. The ones that come here are the people who want to work. It's too hard to get in here and be here for a whole mass of people to get in here just to commit crimes. You know, it doesn't even make sense.
Yeah.
And of course you can also, if you wanted to do that, you could do that in your own country. You know?
Right. There's opportunities right there if you want to do that.
Right. Exactly. They also understand that they're going to suffer more for criminal behavior. So they're less likely to break the law. So it's not necessarily that they're better people, but they understand the consequences, you know, of, you know, a DACA recipient, you know, these are the dreamer, the kids that have deferred action protection. They can't even associate, like be friends with someone with a criminal activity past because that jeopardizes their status. So you can't even associate with people, you know, and they don't because they want to keep their status. And so, yeah, they take it very seriously. And I know the consequences for them would be great. So yeah, that's one of the biggest myths out there. But yeah, one of the things that I tell people is just that immigrants are good neighbors. As immigration rates increase, crime decreases, because these are people that are here to work.
Yeah. And if it's, and you know, the country was made by flourished, I should say, that country flourished because of immigrants coming here. And usually what happens is the sons and daughters of immigrants, their parents are going, get an education.
You know? Right.
They're pushing them to get the most out of their time here because it was bought with such a price to get here. And they usually are, you know, going after college and trying to get good jobs and trying to make things better, you know, for the immigrants are trying to make things better for their kids. And I think that's the spirit in which I think the best of America is embodied, in that spirit. And so I guess my heart kind of cries for, like, can we fix this problem? Now, I have no idea how to do it, but at least we can build some bridges of understanding. Is that there's a lot of things going back and forth. I think a lot of purposefully maligning rhetoric that it doesn't help anybody out. But hopefully we can get some compassion, some real stories out there that shed some more light on the topic.
Yeah. And that's really my goal. It's just for there to be more information out there because, yeah, I mean, like you said, no one wants to leave their home. There's a Somali poet who has this line that says, no one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. You know, and I always remember that as a very powerful image of the fact that they don't want to be here. They wish they could remain in their own country. And so when they're in our country, you know, for us to make them more vulnerable, and especially for the church to support something that harms an immigrant population and that makes them more vulnerable to exploitation or crime or abuse, that just really is heartbreaking to me. And so, you know, so that's really the goal of my organization is to serve the immigrant population so that they don't experience these things. They can flourish as human beings were meant to, you know, as all of us have the opportunity to.
Karen, would you like to talk a little bit about your podcast? Because we didn't get to that yet, and you are a fellow podcaster, so.
Sure. Yeah, so I have a podcast called the Dovetail Podcast. We are the only podcast that is not about carpentry. So that's called Dovetail. And we talk about culture and justice and faith. And we do it primarily from the perspective of people of color. So we try to, my podcast co-host, Courtney Hawley, she's an attorney and she's also a writer. And so we talk about different issues of justice and the way that they intersect with faith and culture. So yeah, so it's called Dovetail. You can find it on, you know, wherever you get your podcasts.
Mm-hmm. Very good. How long have you been doing that?
I would say a little less than a year. Mm-hmm. So we do it just monthly. We have one episode per month. So
that's manageable. I was doing two a week, and I was going completely insane.
Yeah.
I was like, what am I doing? I'm killing myself here.
Yeah, that's a lot of work. People don't realize it. They think you just, you know, start talking.
Just no. Talk and it just goes out magically, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah. This will be how we close up. You can just leave any last words of wisdom that you have for everybody, what you would like them to take away, and then where people can find you and what you're up to.
Sure. So I think my last word is there's this great quote by Representative John Lewis who says, you know, there's good trouble and there's bad trouble. And good trouble is when we stand up to injustice. And so I feel like with any issue, not just immigration, there's trouble that you will stir up for yourself in speaking up and standing up for something. But that's the good kind of trouble. It's the kind of trouble that is on the side, you know, that God is on. And so that is my final word in terms of advocacy and standing up to injustice. And they can find me. I'm on Twitter at _ Karen J. Gonzalez. And you can find me there musing about theology and immigration and other stuff. And I'm on Facebook too, but not quite as, you know, Twitter is actually my preferred social media platform.
Great.
Yeah.
So, muchas gracias, mujerista.
De nada, gracias a ti.
That's about all the Spanish I can do. I was born in Puerto Rico when my parents went down there and they wanted to have a church, and they were part of a church. And so I was totally bilingual. I didn't realize that I was, because you don't realize these things, but I would come inside from talking to my little friends, you know, like a preschooler, and I felt so embarrassed for them to have broken English that when I talked to my mom, I'd go, mommy, my friend wants to talk to you and ask you a question. And I would talk like this, and my mom would look at me like, have you gone crazy? And I was like, it's just because Joanna doesn't speak English. I'm just talking to you like that in front of her, but when she leaves, we'll talk normally again. And then when we moved to Pittsburgh, and within 4 or 5 months, it was gone, like from not talking to my little friends, and we didn't speak it in the house, pretty much left me.
Yeah, I believe it. It's like one of those things.
Yeah, you don't use it and you kind of lose it. So I can understand a good bit, but I'm so embarrassed to speak it because it's so mangled and preschoolish still. And when I took it in, when I took Spanish in high school and in college, they would hear my pronunciation was pretty good. And so they would, and they saw my last name was Colon, and they would have all these big hopes, you know, and then I would just massively disappoint them. I was like, sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so Anglo, really, I can't, I'm sorry. And so they would be like, oh, well, oh, okay, you're just one of those, you're a poser. But I keep thinking what I need is, like, I couldn't do grammar that good, but if I was immersed, I'd like to think that I could pick it up.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
you pick it up fast because you have so much background in it already.
I would like to think so, but, you know, I don't. Anyway, thank you so much for being my guest. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
And I enjoy following you, and keep up the great work. I love what you do.
Thank you. It was great to talk to you, Lisa. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you about things that I'm passionate about.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass, and you can access the access pass for just $1. It unlocks all show note episodes, too. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.